This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's show, Terry's conversation with one of the most prolific and respected bass players in contemporary jazz, Ron Carter. Carter has performed on more than a couple thousand albums, with performers ranging from Eric Dolphy to Aretha Franklin. He was the leader on about 50 of those recordings. From 1963 to 68, he was part of Miles Davis's now legendary rhythm section, along with drummer Tony Williams and pianist Herbie Hancock. Carter played on several Miles Davis albums, including Seven Steps to Heaven, Sorcerer, Nefertiti, Fee to Kilimanjaro, and Miles Smiles. Ron Carter's latest recording, The Golden Striker, on Blue Note Records, is with Mulgrew Miller on piano and Russell Malone on guitar.
Now, you play bass and cello. You started with cello, right?
Yes. I was 10 years old.
How did you take it up? Was it through school?
Well, you know, in those days, and I'm going pretty far back, I guess, the teacher for the district would come by with a carload of instruments, and she would unload them into the auditorium and have everyone who was interested in music as a broad category visit, and we would have a choice of what instruments we thought could produce the sounds we were most interested in, and my interest happened to be the cello.
Did you have teachers or other adults discourage you and tell you that, well, you could do that technically, but practically it was going to be very difficult because you're African-American?
That didn't happen until I got into my later years in high school. I was 16, 17, I guess. And I looked around, and I began to realize that all the little outside activities that the orchestra participated in that were of a paying sort, they went to everyone else in the orchestra in the cello section, and somehow I never got the invitation to be a part of this situation. This is way before the really civil rights movement took place in 64, so I'm talking 37, 49, 50, 51.
And this is in Detroit?
1951, yeah, in Detroit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there was only one bass player in the orchestra at the time, and when he graduated, the logical thing to do, it seemed to be, rather than become angry, it seemed to be to put me in a position that they would have to call me. So I switched to bass my senior year in high school, which would be January of 1955.
So how far did you get in the classical world, and how did you start playing jazz?
How far did I get? About 8 steps, I think.
And that's officially not far, right?
it's far enough to have them tell me that we love the way you play, but the orchestra's not ready for African-American players.
Did people actually tell you that?
Oh, yeah. I was told that several times.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I was in school, my friend and I, who was a saxophone player, started a little jazz posse at the local nightclub called the Pithot Hall, which was across from the emotional other side of the tracks. He turned out to be eventually the saxophonist who did the arrangements for James Brown, all those bigger hit records he had, Cold Sweat and I Feel Good and so on. We started a jazz posse there, and so I would play there during the evenings, during the late nights, actually, and get up in time for my 8 o'clock theory class at the Eastman School of Music. So I was already aware of the jazz community and starting to earn money for continuation of education through my little jazz gigs. The spring of 1958, Chico Hamilton rolled into town with a jazz package show that featured Miles Davis Band, Dave Brubeck Quartet, Lambert Hendricks and Ross, and the Amanda Ferguson Big Band. And Chico Hamilton's band had at the time a cello player, Nat Gershwin, Eric Dolphy, and Dennis Budimir playing guitar, and Chico, and they were looking for a cello player. So I had an audition for the band. He told me that since I had a year to go in school, I should finish school and see him in New York, which would be the following year, 1959. Well, I did finish school and graduated from Eastman and went to New York August 59. And when I arrived in New York, Chico was working at Birdland, which was then on 52nd Street and Broadway. And the bass player in the band had decided to leave the band. So he asked me, would I want to join the band as a bass player? And of course I said yes, and we left the next week going on a three-month tour of the States.
Well, let me play a recording from early in your career. And we were talking about how you started with cello before changing to bass as your primary instrument. Mm-hmm. This is a 1960 recording that you made with Eric Dolphy, on which you play cello. George DeVivier plays bass. It's a composition called Feather. And we're going to hear Eric Dolphy on alto saxophone, you on cello, DeVivier bass, Roy Haynes on drums. Would you say something about this recording? It's a classic.
Yeah, well, George DeVivier is one of the two or three people who I've met who have put the bass performance level on such a high professional standard. I always call George DeVivier and Milt Hinton my musical uncles because mm-hmm. they really opened the door to all that the jazz players today are privileged to have the chance to do. They played great notes. They played really well in tune. They were always on time for the jobs. They always wore suits and ties, and they had the instruments in prime shape to perform whatever music they were being called to play on. And I think those five items makes a bass player today have a great height to aspire to. A lovely man, and I'm sorry he's gone.
Feather, recorded in 1960 with Eric Dolphy on alto saxophone, my guest Ron Carter on cello, George DeVivier bass, and Roy Haynes drums. I often think that Dolphy's playing was a little sharp, and it gave him this literal cutting edge that just kind of cut through anything, and then just stuck out in a real ear-catching way. Was he sharp, and if he was, how did that affect your intonation?
Well, he always played sharp. I think guys who play the instrument that hard, physically hard, tend to play sharp because they overblow the instrument. It used to drive me crazy. I just tell Eric, man, you're playing sharp. Can you pull out? Can you do something else? You know, when you're playing in the orchestras all the time, and while orchestras generally play a little above the pitch so the violins sound more brilliant, I guess, you get used to playing above the pitch, but everyone's playing above the pitch, not just one person. So it made me really tune in to where the pitch was supposed to be and made me probably more self-conscious than I should have been how much above the pitch Eric really was. There were nights when he would nail intonation. I mean, he'd be perfect, and then the bass would just do what he could do easier because it wasn't caught between my pitch and Eric's pitch. And there were other nights when he would be so sharp that it'd be difficult to make my hands do what my ear was telling me was correct, but my inner sense was saying that can't be okay.
I want to jump to the period of your life in the 60s when you were playing with Miles Davis. You were with him mm-hmm. from 63 to 68?
Yes.
You were playing with Art Farmer before joining Miles Davis. How did you end up joining Miles?
Well, as it turned out, the band that he then had was going through several personnel changes. While this was going on, Miles came into the Half Note one night when I had just into the second night of my 2-week gig with Art Farmer, with Jim Hall, and he called me over and asked me if I was interested in joining his band. He told me that the band was breaking up, he was putting together a new group, and wanted me to go to California with him the following week to work at the Black Hawk for the beginning of a 6-week tour. And I said I was very interested. However, I just joined Art for these 2 weeks here, and if he would ask Art if it was okay, and if Art said yes, I'd be happy to go. If Art said no, then I'd be happy to stay with Art. So when the set was over, we called Art over, and they had a talk. They had known each other for years, and he told Art what he had in mind, and Art said it was okay, and I think that did two things for me. It established with Miles that I was really my own person, and it showed Art what kind of regard I had for him.
Were there things that Miles Davis told you about what he was doing or what he wanted you to do when you first started playing with him?
No, he would make sure, though, that I stood next to him. During those days, 63 and on, the bass player didn't have an amplifier, and there were no monitors on the stage, at least for the jazz bands. And everything was pretty much wide open, literally. So the instrument that had the lowest power output was the bass. That was the case in any band, so he would make sure that I stood as close to him as the stage would allow so he could understand or he could hear what was going on with the bass line. And occasionally he would say he would notice that the sound was different because I'd been off for 3 weeks, and he would say, "Your hand's a little tender tonight." Or he would say, "What is that note doing there?" And I'd explain to him what it was. He would say, "Okay." But he never once told me I should do this or I should play this kind of note or I should play on this part of the instrument. He kind of trusted my sense of judgment.
Why don't we play a recording from that early period in which you worked with Miles Davis?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we hear My Funny Valentine? And I think your bass playing on this is almost like a heartbeat. That's My Funny Valentine with Miles Davis, my guest Ron Carter on bass, and that was Tony Williams on drums, recorded in 1964, live at Philharmonic Hall at Lincoln Center in New York. That's a beautiful recording. Was there something special about playing ballads with Miles Davis during that period?
Well, you know, the story is still going around that he learned a lot of space from listening to Ahmed Jamal, and that story is true. Listening to him play ballads kind of validates that view. He once said that he liked the way I played ballads with him because I understood what the melody would sound like even if he didn't play it. So I enjoyed playing ballads with him.
Oh, you mean so that you can apply the melody even if he was playing something else?
That's right.
Right. Miles Davis was not very communicative with his audience on stage, not verbally communicative. Was he more communicative with the musicians?
By and large, yes. Again, you know, when we go back to those early days of clubs and concerts, the setting that is now available with separate microphone and great microphones and great microphone stands and really aware technicians and sound crews. I mean, the whole industry has changed as far as sonically reproducing a concert for an audience, be it club or concert. And then the situation was not easy for someone to announce a tune and then run back to the microphone and play. Then when it's finished, put your horn down and run back to that microphone again and announce the next song. It just wasn't physically convenient. Why he didn't talk to the audience, however, is something I can't answer.
Mm-hmm.
When we play now, I'd use segues between tunes, not because that's what he couldn't do, but I just find that if I can play a set and start a story from the first note and have you turn the page in your mind and let my conversation not be that page-turning for you.
Right.
It's like having call waiting, you know, and that really annoys me to have call waiting, to have an announcer say, now we're going to play, ladies and gentlemen. For me, that doesn't work. So I play a set for however long it lasts, straight through with these brief musical interludes to allow you to turn your own page. And I think that if he had thought of this during his time, he would have done as well.
Shortly after you joined Miles Davis, Herbie Hancock and Tony Williams joined, forming the classic Miles Davis Quintet of the mid-60s. What changed musically when you were all together?
Well, I think this was one of the cases where each of us, Herbie, Wayne, Tony, myself, would have ended up where we are now. But we ended up where we are now much quicker because we were all in the same pot then. Wynn was a very a quiet person, but he wrote great lines and had a great sense of harmonic direction.
This is Wayne Shorter you're talking about.
Wayne Shorter.
Who
yeah.
I neglected to mention. Thank you.
Yeah, that's okay. And Herbie was starting to explore not so much new chord voicings, but places to play these new sounds. And Tony, who was at the time 17, was just opening the drums to a set of rhythms that no one had contemplated were being possible to be done on the drums. And I think my angle, if I can use that word, would be what note ties all this stuff together.
Now, you know, Tony Williams was departing from just playing the rhythm. He was doing all kinds of
yes, absolutely.
Things. And did that make it any more or less necessary for you to be playing the rhythm?
Well, Tony was very form-oriented. Tony knew melodies inside and out, and he was studying composition and arranging. So I think one of my inputs to the band was to outline the form, because we were doing so many things within the structure. And because Herbie was playing these new chord voicings and Wayne was writing these different kind of melodies and Tony was exploring all these rhythms on different parts of the drum, in addition to what I was trying to do, I kind of nailed the form down for everybody as best I could.
So you saw yourself as being the kind of harmonic and rhythmic foundation that enabled everybody else to be more free.
Yes.
One other Miles Davis record I want to play here, and this is one of the first electric recordings that you made with him.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to hear Toot Sweet from Feed to Kilimanjaro. Mm-hmm. Did Miles Davis tell you that he wanted you to play electric bass? I mean, how did you switch then from bass to electric bass?
Well, you know, during that time, there used to be these called Blue Monday sessions. And these were clubs that had music starting at 3 a.m. in the morning, and they would go until 7 a.m. in the morning. And they were generally organ-led trios, organ, guitar, and drums. And occasionally they'd have an electric bass player who would fill in for the organist's left hand or left foot. And so I got involved in doing that even when I was going to Eastman. When I came to New York in 1959 and got involved in making a few commercial recordings, jingles, The electric bass was just now becoming a part of the recorded sound. And so every upright player had to go out and buy one to get a better view on how to play this instrument that they were now being called on to have available should the producer decide that's the sound he wanted. So the instrument was not new to me. I'd made records with it before. But I told Miles that, you know, this instrument is okay, but it doesn't have the sound that I hear that I've been working on for a very long time to get better every night at, and this just doesn't allow me that growth that I think I have to have. But it's your band, and I'll do the best I can. I think I'll do a credible job, but this is really not what I want to do.
What was it? What was missing in the sound of the electric bass?
Well, for me, just the ability to change the tone quality with my hands. I mean, bass players do it now with a pick and with their thumb and the various pedals and stuff, and they do a great job. But the color really doesn't change that much. And I think the upright player who is really conscious of the sound choices he has at his command with his hands will miss those choices playing electric bass.
Well, why don't we hear Feed to Kilimanjaro?
Mm-hmm. It's a nice track.
Yeah, this is Toot Sweet.
Yeah.
My guest, Ron Carter, on electric bass. This is the Miles Davis Quintet. Miles Davis Quintet with my guest Ron Carter on electric bass, recorded in 1967 from the album Feed to Kilimanjaro. We were talking about you playing electric bass on this. Herbie Hancock is playing electric piano. How did you feel playing with electric piano?
Well, you know, it was really difficult to get the sounds separated at that time. I mean, they really hadn't learned how to really record a jazz band playing these instruments because their touch is so different, and they're playing a different combination of notes and a lot more notes. They weren't being so technically conservative as they were on the early recordings of Fender Rhodes and electric bass. So it presented to them a recording problem, and I'm not sure they really solved that problem on that particular recording.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, when they were able to re-edit and remaster and remix, and with the new formats, they got a much better separation of instruments than they did on the original vinyl. But, you know, again, you know, the sounds were so almost indistinct for me, it was difficult to feel apart from everyone else, but still a part of it.
Did your dissatisfaction with the electric bass and the electric piano direction that Miles Davis was going in have anything to do with you leaving the quintet?
No, I just thought it was time to go. I'd been with the band 5 years, five fabulous years. I had a son who was 60, going on 5 years old, 6 years old. Another who was going on 2 or 3, and I thought that it's best for me to start spending more time than I was able to do with Miles' travel schedule. So I left just because of those personal reasons. Also, they were starting to get some more jazz recordings in New York. I mean, there were a lot of companies doing a lot of jazz records. The studio scene, as I defined it, was really becoming more active, and they were There were more African-American players being a part of these commercial recordings, and it seemed like the best time to try to find out what the industry had to offer was to be a part of it. And you can't do that if you travel 6 weeks, 6 weeks at a time for months on end.
So did your plan succeed? Were you able to stay home more and spend more time with your family?
Yes, and I'm happy to have done that.
Yeah, well, you've recorded how many CDs as a leader and a sideman over the years?
Well, you know, the last count from a friend of mine in Japan who is determined to track them all down, and he's found some really that I have completely escaped me. He's got 2,200 and change, something like that.
Yeah, very impressive. Now, I know you were on a recording by the hip-hop group, A Tribe Called Quest. Did they sample you, or did you play with them?
No, I went to the studio. I mean, the guy called me, Q-Tip called me one afternoon and told me who he was, and he was a great fan of Charlie Mingus. And I said, oh, yeah, great. You know, we're going to do it for you. You know, he said, well, we're making this record, and I want to know if you want to participate. I said, well, let me call you back because I'm busy for the moment. Actually, I was going to call my son, who was on top of that stuff. So I called him. I said, hey, man, who's this guy Q-Tip and Trap Clockers? Are they musically okay? He said, oh, yeah, Dad, you got to check them out. So I called him back, and I said, okay, we can do this. Just give me time and a place, and we work it out. They're a really lovely young man, and they're really curious about music, and I had a great time with them.
Do you still practice, or is that unnecessary because you already play so much?
You know, I just retired from City College, and that frees me up to have 20 hours a week more to practice, and I practice every day.
Good. Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, Ron Carter.
Terry, thanks very much for the invitation, and hello to your audience, and thank them for encouraging this music.
Ron Carter spoke with Terry Gross last year. His new CD as leader is called The Golden Striker. He also recorded with the Brazilian singer Rosa Passos. Here's something from their new CD, Entre Amigos. Que eu desafino.